Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Maui Nui is on a mission to help balance axis deer populations for the good of our environment, communities, and food systems. On the island of Maui, they've shared over 126,000 pounds of nutrient-dense protein with the Maui community. Secure your spot now, become a snack subscriber, and join in helping to build more resilient food and ecosystems on Maui. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com, that's MauiNuiVenison.com, and use promo code BEAR for 20% off your first order. Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more. My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is a production of the Bear Grease Podcast called the Bear Grease Render, where we render down, dive deeper, and look behind the scenes of the actual Bear Grease Podcast. Presented by FHF Gear, American-made, purpose-built hunting and fishing gear that's designed to be as rugged as the places we explore. Welcome to the Bear Grease Render. This is the late August edition, the Bear Grease Render.
The hottest one of the year.
Dog days. Yep.
The hottest Bear Grease Render of the year.
It was 103 in my truck pulling up.
Was it? Yep. 103. Do you know what is unusual about Ursus Americanus, the American black bear, is that it's an animal with a black coat, lots of fat, thick hair all year round. They're not like a mule that has like a thick coat in the winter and then sheds it. Like, they're pretty much hairy the whole year. Temperature doesn't seem to affect bears, for real. Like, when guys hunt in the fall, the best thing that it could be, Joe, on opening day for an Arkansas bear season would be that it would be 90 degrees.
No kidding.
No, I mean, it's totally backwards from deer hunting.
Well, you know, I've got some black hair, some fat.
You like the heat too?
Yeah, what's your take?
My take is I've been searching for a town named November, April. Oh. And if I can move there, I'll be at peace for the remainder of my life, because I just think that those 2 months are the premium months of the year.
Those are some El Primo months.
Let's just honor this bear for being able to tolerate all that it tolerates.
Well, we've kind of got a skeleton crew here on the render this week. We had one guy that was coming, was charged by a bear,
threw
him off, must have thrown his schedule off. Colby Moorhead, owner of Bear Hunting Magazine, on his way here, had a great story, but I guess the bear charge messed up his schedule, and now he's not going to be able to come.
He probably messed up more than one schedule.
Yeah, maybe so. He probably had to go home and change clothes, didn't he?
I believe his schedule's messed up for a few hours.
To be fair, if a bear charged me, I'd need more than an afternoon to walk that off. So, yeah.
But we do have Joe Wilson.
Yes, sir.
The founder of the World Championship Squirrel Cook-Off.
Yeah.
I told you we were going to have you back on before the event in September. So it's good to have you. Joe's kind of like a one-man circus when it comes to podcasts. Joe's the El Primo podcast guest. I could just be like, welcome to the Bear Grease Render. Take it, Joe. And Joe could just start talking.
You want Jonathan out of leave?
Yeah. But we have Joe's sidekicks. No, you guys just met Joe today. But longtime friend, Ben Legrone. Good to see you,
good
Ben.
Good afternoon.
It's good to have you. Ben's been he's been getting some pictures of some nice deer. And then my other longtime friend, Jonathan Webster.
What's up? I'm really just here for the apple butter. I was hoping that there might be a second render of apple. I missed my opportunity.
You know what? If I'd have thought about it, I'd have brought a jar out and I would have said, the most valuable guest of the day gets the jar.
Joe gets the jar.
We're talking the apple butter.
Yeah, yeah, you can do anything for apple butter, wouldn't you?
Oh, man, that apple butter, boy.
Man, okay, my conversation today is kind of revolving around bears because yesterday we started baiting bears. We did our inaugural trip into the mountains to bait bears, so I'm thinking about bears. Apple butter, though, 15, 18 years ago when we bought this land, we've lived here almost 20 years. I started buying apple trees. And I'm going to give you an orchard lesson. Inside the lesson, you're going to learn about a little bit about bears, not much, but you're going to learn more about orchards. The best time to start an orchard was 5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you better start it now so that 5 years from now you'll be happy. When I bought this place, I started buying discount apple trees in like mid-summer.
That's a thing?
At Lowe's,
the ones with no leaves.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah, the little crooked ones with like four leaves that are like $12.99. Used to be $29.99.
I didn't know the floor model applied to agriculture.
Oh yeah, that's the same way I buy ribeyes. I wait till they get that yellow tag on them.
Yeah,
my father-in-law calls it half rotten.
Yeah, well, half price too.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. That's mistake number one. If you're going to plant an orchard, you need to go not to your big box stores. You need to go to a local nursery and find the disease resistant and the good species of peach, apple, cherry, whatever you're after that will grow in your region, because Lowe's doesn't care.
Right.
So I started planting these trees. I started planting these trees, and basically today, 17, 18 years later, I have six good apple trees that are probably 6 inches at the base. I mean, like full grown apple trees. And they have produced sporadic yields for all these years. But the life lesson from this, Joe, is that I've got six beautiful trees. I bet I've planted 25.
Did blight get them?
Wow.
Man, weed eaters got them, deer got them, drought got them.
Because you know the history in Arkansas with the apple trees.
Yes.
I don't. What's that?
Well, I mean,
this is coming back to apple butter.
Okay.
Take it,
Joe. The podcast of one. Here we go.
So, like, if you're driving through Bentonville, we got a street called Moberly, and that was home of Moberly apples, right? And so between apple cider, apple vinegar, and apples, Arkansas was the place.
It was Northwest Arkansas was exporting America's apples.
Yeah, we were
for a time period.
Where Washington gets the credit now, that's what Arkansas was for few decades, multiple decades. Yep. And then a blight come through. It's the same blight that took out the chicopin, oak, and wiped out these apples. And so our farmers had to come up with a new idea, and just so happens they got feathers on them. We started poultry directly after.
Chicken farming.
That was our backup plan, huh?
Yeah.
So the apples used to be big here, exporting apples all over. So there is an apple blight. And so those traditional, like, mainstream strains of apples die. So you need to get, like, I think there's one called Arkansas Black. That's real good. But these are big box store apple trees that have survived. They just produce a real good crop every couple of years. But this year, they produced a good crop. But the whole point of the story, Jonathan, you keep distracting me, was I planted those trees for bear bait. That's why I planted them. I mean, that's 100% why I planted them. I wanted good, cheap bear bait. But today, my family makes apple butter off of those trees. It's secondary use. It's kind of like not best use, but good enough.
How many sacks of apples did you carry off in the woods?
I didn't use very many of them for baiting bears.
It was a great idea, though.
It was a great idea back in the day.
I hear you.
But yesterday I only took about probably 30, 40 pounds of apples that were on the ground.
What's the prime apple or the prime bear bait? I mean, is it Little Debbie treats, day old donuts?
Anything that'll make a human fat and unhealthy, a bear will love. I'm getting my bait from a commercial bear bait distributor. There's several big commercial bear bait distributors that send stuff all over the country. There are companies that deal with the waste,
the byproduct, or
big. How I don't know where it comes from, but there's a lot of really great food that goes to waste and goes to animal feed and bear bait. So like yesterday, we were buying granola stuff with candies and gummies and marshmallows and circus peanuts and stuff like that. But we also use corn and dog food. I mean, I've baited bears with just about everything. They like bread, donuts, all that stuff.
Back in 2009, I was working at a local restaurant, and you called me up and asked about getting into the grease trap and getting the leftover fry grease. And I think we made that happen.
I think you were going to bring this up.
Listen, it worked. I guess. I mean, you came and got it.
Oh yeah, grease is really good.
Can I ask you?
That's how you got on the render. He hadn't forgotten.
That's the 14 years ago. The solid contribution of 5 pounds of grease.
Is a spring bear tastier than a fall bear?
I have never been able to tell the difference.
Really?
I have not.
Because, you know, like for our squirrels, for the squirrel cook-off, a spring squirrel is twice the squirrel as a fall.
Really?
Well, that's because them squirrels are climbing up the trees and they're eating that old bitter, you know, hull off of the hickory nuts or the walnuts or the pecans or whatever. And so that bitter taste actually transfers into the meat. So I was just...
Now, is that in the spring or the fall?
That's in the fall.
Okay.
So in the spring, the squirrel's eating berries and sweet, you know, sweet grains and all of this nice, good food that translates right in. I mean, it's no different than a finished beef cow compared to a grass.
Joe, I don't think my palate is delicate enough to be able to,
Clay,
to tell the difference. But they do say that for sure in the spring, a bear is going to be more lean than a fall bear. And so people would... like a fall bear would be, and I don't like using this term because I don't think
the greasy deal.
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, bear's not any more greasy than a ribeye beefsteak or you take my bear meat that I grind, that we make burgers out of, meatloaf, spaghetti, tacos, and brown it next to a plate, a deal of 80-20 beef. And you're going to have way more fat in that 80-20 beef than you are in my bear meat.
That bear you got in Alaska this year, we were there. We got a bear week before you.
Yep.
We got two bears, and neither of them had any fat on them.
Mm.
I mean, those bears, I think if they would have stayed in their holes for a couple more days, they probably wouldn't have made it. But
did them a favor.
Yeah. I mean, these were the scrawniest, skinny, no-fat bears. They were low-fat.
Low fat.
They were probably better for you
than
that greasy one that you got. But yeah, I've always thought that bear is not greasy. I don't know where that come from.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's good reason to say that, because they do in the fall can have a huge amount of fat on them, but it's not in the meat. It's not marbled like beef.
Yeah.
And if it was, it would be even better than it is. I mean, like marbling in beef is what.
Yeah,
is what the you try
desired
to,
thing.
Yeah. And wild game just doesn't marble quite like that. But yeah,
they got to handle them like those Kobe cows, where they go out and you know, massage them and play music. That's that high quality bear.
That's what we call our black squirrels.
Oh,
yeah, El Primo.
They're the Angus of the squirrel world. You know.
I wonder
Angus
if
squirrel.
I should leave some like classic. Music playing at my bear baits.
Oh man,
you think it would make them?
You'd get primo marbling.
You think so?
Well, Joe. Well, before we get into Joe, before Joe takes over the podcast,
I'm sorry.
No, this is good. This is good. Ben, you have a Ben has a dad class,
and I heard about it on a previous show. Awesome.
I think it's pretty good. Tell us what's the dad class, Ben?
Okay, this is like my magnum opus. I mean,
your life's work.
I mean, it really is. So, for some context, I'm a influencer in like the fatherhood space, and I've had the privilege to work with a lot of men, do a lot of teaching, mentoring inside men's ministry and other contexts. And in January, I went on like a pilgrimage, basically, to answer two questions: what specifically makes a great father? And how do I become one? And through that, and I've surveyed data and talked to people, probably like 130 dads. And through that developed something called the Framework for Fatherhood. And it's like a document that just captures succinctly what makes a good dad. And it's a tool that you can think about your strengths as a man and a tool that you can think about areas to improve. And from that, I developed like a curriculum. It's an online course. It's self-paced. And
This is what you guys do with your business.
Yeah. So
is you make online courses
for families, childbirthing
and for families. And so this fits right in this lineage of what you are
doing. Like, we hope someday that it's an online learning hub for learning how to build an awesome family. And so the Dad Class, that's what it's called. And you can read about it at dadclass.net. Pretty simple.
Wow. Sketchy.
Dadclass.net.
I'm surprised Elon Musk didn't own that.
Yeah, well, he's making a bid. We'll
he
see.
Owns the .com version.
No, that's actually true. I can't afford that. So it's a self-paced program that you can go through. But I know guys are going through it together, like as friends. You could go through it as a men's group at your church or something. And it's not necessarily Christian-based, but there is a really in-depth Bible study companion that goes along with it.
If you wanted that.
Optional.
But if you didn't, you didn't have to have
You don't
that.
Have to. But anyway, there's four modules. The first one is about manhood. And Joe and I were talking about earlier about a simple question, like what really makes a man, and diving into that. And so in that module, we look at that question and we look at the influences your father had on you. You look at all the things that influence you as a man. We talk about marriage in that module. The second module, we dive into the framework for fatherhood. And that's broken into fatherhoods and four big overarching skills or competencies: leadership, relationships, shepherding, and legacy. And that module is awesome. It is awesome. It's been life-changing for me to develop, and it's been life-changing for guys that are going through it. And then the third module is called Fathering Over Time. And that's where I take a lot of my knowledge of childhood development from my early education days. I used to work in public schools. And so we look at the stages of child development and talk about how fathering shifts and changes as your kids age, all the way up into young adult. And then the fourth module is something called Brand New Dad Bootcamp. So the whole course, any dad of any age, there's a one guy taking the course, he's a grandfather. So guys of any age can take it. But that's a special module for brand new dads. It's like a crash course, a survival guide. if you are a new dad and you know nothing. And I'm really excited. So we just launched it a couple weeks ago, and you can learn about it.
So people are already taking the class and stuff.
Yeah, all over the nation. And it's mostly guys that have taken my wife and I's childbirth class and stuff. But that's one of the biggest requests that I've got. It was, hey, I really want to be the best dad I can be. Do you have any resources from me? I get that question all the time. And then number two, where can I find support? So actually, when you buy the class, you get on this online private group that I moderate, and you can get on there and ask questions. You know, in the future, we hope to have like special live sessions and stuff like that.
That's cool, man. Just this week, I sent Ben a screen clip from a private message somebody had sent to me, a Bear Grease Render listener who said, Clay, I wish you had more stuff about your family and how you raise your family. And he was a young father interested in fatherhood. And I clipped it and sent it to you.
Yeah.
And
that's what we're looking for.
People are interested in it. That's the point.
I'm interested.
Yeah. You know,
Joe, you said on your podcast, you ask everybody, one of the questions is, what does it mean to be a man?
We've asked 100 men what it means to be a man. And traditionally, you have about four responses. One is do what you say. And it's hard work. And it's being a member of the community. And a lot of times, friendship, you know, being a good friend, being a good father, all of that comes in. We also ask the question, did your dad ever tell you he loved you? And for people, I'm about 50 years old, you know, and for people my age and older, the answer is almost always no.
Really?
almost always no.
Man, that is shocking.
But for 50 years and younger, the answer is almost always yes. And there was something that happened maybe in the 80s, I don't know, that changed this. Now, unless that guy that we asked the question to went through some major physical or mental abuse, the response is he didn't have to tell me. I knew. And so that's across the board. You'll hear that. The reason why I'm interested in your class is I have a 17-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of gap them apart a little bit.
There should be another one on the way with this math, Joe.
Hey, trust me, the doctor said that can't happen. But
I believe in miracles.
The deal is, I do. I believe in miracles. But the deal is, to me, is I had a phenomenal relationship with my daughter until she was probably 12 and a half going on 13. This little girl caught every perch with me. We deer hunted. She cleaned deer with me. She was my shotgun rider. We ate donuts. Every time we could eat donuts, we hit the park. And then the dear Lord decided he was going to turn her into a woman, and things kind of changed. And it's been a struggle. Now, my goal right now is I'm playing kind of like Batman. I live in a cave, and if she ever needs me, she can shine that light, and I'll come running and fix whatever it is that needs to be fixed. But I'm playing a game right now where space keeps her from hating me, you know? I mean, you want to talk about getting your heart broken, and I guarantee you're going to have a ton of your listeners say that teenage year is evil. I mean, it changes. And that kid. I remember getting angry whenever I was a teenager. I mean, we're not in rut. We're at that point to where, you know, we're trying to prove who we are, and we're a man, we can handle her. Or you're a girl and a woman. It's a tough, tough time, brother. And I'm sure you'll have a lot of men, if they open up to you, they'll tell you that a little girl can break a tough guy's heart pretty dang easy. And it sucks. It's a bad, bad deal. But being older, I've watched men go through this, and I know what the end game is. Those little girls are going to come back, and they're going to find out that dad was just trying to protect them. You mm-hmm. know, what do you say?
You
on
know,
that?
When you brought up the deal about the older generation not telling their kids they loved them, and then now it would be unusual for any group of people probably to not tell their kids they loved them. And my question was, do you think that the kids that are being told they're loved really feel loved? You know, and I don't know the answer. It's not really a trick question, but the idea is that if you say something, well, because you said that a lot of the guys that dad never told them they loved them,
they knew
they were loved because of the action. And now there's probably just as many guys that would say, man, my dad was a warlord. You know, and like at some level he loved me, but he was kind of I mean, there's probably different versions of it.
I think that that's the part that made us know that they loved us, is because they gave us rules and restrictions and guidance that if they didn't love us, why would they tell us that? And so, for a dad to enforce that, no, son, you're wrong.
Well, it's like, what is love? Is love letting your kid do whatever they want all the time and giving them everything they want? Or is love, you know, disciplining them in the right time and giving them correction and putting boundaries on their life and not letting them do this and that?
It's the highlight of our life to have our children. It's our legacy is what we leave behind in them. Clay's deal, taking Bear out and dropping him off in the woods and letting him kill a bear. I couldn't get away with that deal at my house, right? But
why
would
not?
I she'll whoop me. But would I want to? Absolutely. What Clay has shared with the listeners about how he's raising his family is very, very interesting to me. But I'm old school. And so to a lot of people, you know, they don't want our kids playing out. I live in the country. They don't want our kids playing out there because the boogeyman's going to come kidnap them. There ain't no saber-toothed tiger that's going to take my kid. I'm that kid who would walk just like Brett Reeves. You know, he talked on his show, this current one, to where he would walk on forever. And we knew what time dinner was. We had to get home to it. We'd leave with a pocket full of bullets or a couple hooks. Mm-hmm. And nothing bad. You know what happened? Everything was good. Even the bad times were good. And I kind of feel like we're missing a huge opportunity to our kids by not doing what you're doing, Clay. That's, in my opinion, that's often wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing that you wouldn't see about the freedom that I do give my kids, or it's just not as, it's just not something we just talk about all the time, is I've placed a lot of really strong boundaries on their life too. The reason I can trust Bear Newcomb to go in the woods for 3 days by himself while he's 15 with a bow and all this, and just trust him to be competent enough, is that his whole life I've been there, number one, but I have tested him. I mean, I've been like, okay, here's the rules. The playing field is really huge, but don't go outside the boundaries. And I'm not contradicting like letting free range kids. I mean, my kids have kind of been free range, but inside of a controlled environment, and he's proven to obey the rules and do what's right, make sound judgment. And, you know,
I had a go-kart one time for 15 minutes.
That's the beginning of a good story. Yeah. For sure, beginning of a good story.
I watched my dad in the summer sun put together this go-kart, and I believe it had a Husqvarna chainsaw motor, right? And he worked hard, wrenching and bleeding and stuff, putting this deal together. And he said, son, this is your go-kart. Don't touch the highway with it. And I got on the go-kart, and I drove all the way down the road, and I turned around, but them outside tires touched this thing that he considered the highway.
Mm.
I come back. He said, what'd you think? I said, that's awesome. You know, that's a cool deal. Get off. And he took it all apart, and I never seen it again.
Wow, because you broke the rules.
I broke the rules.
Wow. I'd say that's some good dadding right there.
Forcing some boundaries.
I mean, so, and you know, that was at a young age. That's 9, 10 years old. And I understood at that point what the man said was what the man meant. And if I broke it, I paid the consequences.
You know, if Gary Newcomb were here, the believer himself, I'd tell this story. The most intense moments of my life would be when I was, let's say I was 8 or 9 years old, driving the truck on dirt roads. He'd let us drive.
Yeah.
He was very serious. Dad, I don't know why, but maybe he had kids when he was in school that got killed in car wrecks, and he was very concerned about us being good drivers and safe drivers. I mean, like, he coached us about that so much. So he let us drive on dirt roads, and he'd be in the passenger seat, and we'd be controlling the truck, you know, at some point after proving competency. And he would say, we'd be deer hunting, looking for deer sign. He'd see a deer track on the road or something and would be in, but he'd say, stop. And I remember just kind of like coming to a long stop.
That's when the state troopers get mad at you.
Right, yeah. And he would be like, I said, stop the car. When I say stop, I mean stop. When I say turn, I mean turn. And I mean, we learned real quick, you did exactly what he said, even if you didn't understand it. If he said stop, you stopped, except wheels didn't squeak on dirt roads.
So for the dad expert, I think that's where I've dropped the ball. I think that just like training, it's a bad comparison, but just like training a dog, you give them an inch, they're going to take a mile, right? And I have never been real good at drawing that line. Is drawing that line important in your class?
Absolutely. And first of all, I wouldn't say I'm the expert. I'd just say I'm a learner, and there's no perfect dads, you know.
Actually, come on, Ben. We know you're perfect.
What makes a great dad is somebody who's able to learn and reflect and make changes, even small changes. I think that's what makes a good dad become a great dad, because the world's full of good dads. I mean, honestly, I think 90% of the guys are good dads and love their kids, doing their best. But when you think about sitting down reflecting and making a practical change in your life, that's hard. It's hard work. And that's what this course we try to do. But we absolutely talk about boundaries and we talk about finding balance. So like some guys, they might struggle with being way too harsh, way mm-hmm. too strict. They can't build relationship for nothing. And that's going to bite you in the end. And then you got other guys that struggle to set those boundaries and be consistent. So being a great dad's being aware, okay, what's my natural tendency and trying to identify how to practically change that. That's what I'd say to that. We've all got
having that awareness of yourself.
Yep.
And all of us have a tendency to either be too loose or too strong.
Yep.
You go to one side or the other, and just being aware and knowing that probably somewhere in the middle.
Man, I'm having you on our show.
Okay. I would love to.
I'm telling you, man. Because I think you'd be perfect on our show, because our show is dominated by men listeners and majority of them being a father, and it will play right in with what our goal is. One, you're a younger guy, and one of the values that we've tried to put on our show this season is to prove to the public that the younger generation is absolutely as strong as the older generation. Mm-hmm. Y'all just do stuff a little different. And because that's...
Hey, tell them the name of your podcast.
Cooking Up a Story with Aaron and Joe's. We drop a new one every Thursday on all the things you can listen to them on. And we're a lot different than Clay's show. We are very open to listening to all kinds of things. But if you're a truck driver and you need 3 hours down the highway, tune in, boy, because it's a 3-hour show. But man, you fit in perfect to that. And it's a characteristic, because I work in construction industry. And so I depend on young men to build America. Right. And one of the things that we deal with is that older guys say young guys don't know how to work. Here's what I know. I know young guys, we've got to depend on them, because they're going to fight for our freedom in this country and protect anybody that needs protecting. So we better respect them enough and treat them solid. But your dad and your grandpa and everybody, it's built into us to think that the next generation has done lost it.
Right.
Not every generation feel that
every
way?
Every generation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so when you hear it, you just got to understand that we heard it.
Yep.
And
yep.
they heard it. And so it's just one of those deals. And technology plays a lot into it, because y'all can do stuff faster than we could. I'm pretty good at that Google. But we think that because we don't see you breaking your back, that you ain't doing nothing. And so they call it lazy. You've heard it, right? And it's not the truth. It really ain't, Clay. It's just one of those deals to where we need a better bridge between the younger generation. And until we get it, we're going to be like every other generation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you coming on.
Let's do it.
Plan on it.
Let's do it.
Yeah, man. I'll be listening in.
Sweet.
You got a couple to listen to.
Yeah, I do. Joe really does have a really interesting podcast. They do a good job.
I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. Oh, they do a good
last
job.
Last thing, with the coupon Bear Grease, 25% off.
I love it.
Bear Grease has got a wow,
25% off the
Bear
DAC
Grease
class.
What if I gave you a free squirrel? Is that worth another
25%? Oh, you'd be in. You'd be in.
You've landed in a good place here, man.
DAC class.
DACclass.net.
Right on. That's awesome.
Whitetail Institute launched the food plot revolution in 1988 with a concentration on research and real-world testing of forage products specifically for whitetail deer. Whitetail Institute's research and development team of agronomy experts provide effective, personalized service. I've been using Imperial Whitetail Clover for a long time in a food plot back behind my house. In 2007, I killed the biggest buck of my life over an Imperial Whitetail Clover small quarter-acre food plot. Imperial Whitetail Clover is the only clover scientifically developed through years of selective breeding. Clover Extreme genetic stability provides extreme cold tolerance, disease, and drought tolerance. It really does. Clover is coated with Whitetail Institute's Rain Bond, polymer coating added for enhanced seedling survivability. They have an exclusive offer for Bear Grease listeners, 15% off Imperial Clover when you use the code BEAR at whitetailinstitute.com. That's whitetailinstitute.com and use code BEAR for 15% off. The old timers say that the turkeys start gobbling when the leaves are as big as squirrels' ears and the red buds start popping. And we're about there. And we are there in the South. The Onyx Hunt app is one of my most valuable tools in the spring woods. With tools like coniferous versus deciduous tree distribution layer, you can save time by locating edges or transition areas of mixing habitats from home. Find an area like this with water in close proximity, and more than likely, there will be a goblin turkey nearby. Knowing the exact boundaries of private ground ensures I stay on the right side of the fence, but can easily find public ground to go see if I can't strike a gobbler. If you do get one to sound off, using compass mode and waypoints will help you pinpoint his exact location, allowing you to move in and make the perfect setup to bring him right into your lap. Download the Onyx Hunt app today. You'll be glad you did. Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt this spring. We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that's stood the test of time, Seafoam Motor Treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. You pour it in your gas tank. Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
Clay, I see a little something over there. That's a sharp looking thing with your signature on it. What you got there?
Oh, this is did you hear us talking about this on the last one?
I heard, but I have to see it with my own eyes. This is the
Akron grunt call. And they it's made by Phelps. Phelps is a meat eater company. Yeah. Jason Phelps. Good Me stuff. And Jason Phelps work for the same people. We're coworkers. And we were in Mexico talking about deer calls. And I said, man, I want a deer call that's an inhale, exhale, grunt, bleat deer call. And I'm telling the call master this, and I don't think much about it, but I tell him some specifics that I wanted about it. And he's like, okay. And then he makes this call, and turns out there's nothing like it. There's not another inhale, exhale, grunt call on the market. I didn't realize that he had to overcome some real engineering challenges to make a call that would do that. I thought I was asking him to do something that I just hadn't found yet, you know, in a call. But now what I forgot to mention on the last couple of podcasts is that these are going to be for sale sometime around the 1st of September.
Okay.
So close to when this podcast comes out. But for real, it's not a gimmick. This is like a legit, really good call.
Does it say Akron on it?
Akron, yeah. Yes. It's the Akron Grunter.
That's it?
It's the Akron Grunter because, as you all know, when acorns fall in the early part of the season, that's when you can kill deer. So the acorn is the chicken nugget of the eastern deciduous forest. It's the pinnacle of the deer hunter, bear, squirrel hunter's year. And it's the Akron Grunter. It's the deer hunter's call. It's when you see the acorns fall, that's when you need to be blowing that call. Either way, suck or blow.
That's amazing.
That's pretty, too.
That is amazing. Now,
it's made of white oak.
Why were you intent on having inhale, exhale?
Just so you didn't have to carry two calls. You typically had a grunt call and a bleat call that you had to carry. And in the early season, you wouldn't want to do a buck. If you saw some does that you were interested in shooting, a buck grunt is not necessarily going to get them to come into you. A doe bleat would. So you need the doe bleat. A lot of guys use the cans, really good. Yeah, Primos can. That call kind of revolutionized the deer call world with its simplicity. But this call makes a more, in my opinion, a more robust, louder or soft. You have more control with this than that can, and you don't have to keep up with a can. You know,
I'd never use anything but the can. I didn't even think about.
Yeah, that's you can.
I always thought awesome. Like a soup can with dried corn in it.
Shake it around like a deer feeder going
yeah.
off.
Yeah, I just think, man, if I had a soup can with some dried corn, I'd just rattle this old deal and the deer would come a running.
That it works in Texas.
Yeah,
I think works in Texas. You could put your name on that and probably sell a whole heap of them too. Limited edition.
Yeah. Squirrel Cook-Off.
Man.
September 23rd.
September 23rd in Springdale, Arkansas.
I saw that. You moved locations.
Oh, okay.
Well,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's in my neighborhood.
Yeah, so... You know, Arkansas Game and Fish put a pile of money into putting that place in Springdale.
It's beautiful.
It's a beautiful facility, and they're just not getting the traffic they need. And so they needed a circus act like myself to come out to that deal and show people where it's at. And so on September 23rd, starting about 9 o'clock in the morning, the teams will be doing what they do. And let me tell you, we've got 40 well-qualified teams. Based off of the last time I was on Bear Grease, we brought in a lot of people that had never even heard of the Squirrel Cook-Off.
Really?
Good. Yeah, we've got a fella coming from Kentucky that's, he claims he's number one fan of yours.
Okay.
He's bringing his Kentucky squirrels down.
Okay.
Maybe in like an oak barrel or something. And he's...
Marinated.
Yeah. He's going to bring his Kentucky squirrels in. We've got a team signed up from Massachusetts. Nice. We've got a team coming from Washington State. So when we claim we're a world championship, if those people in France or China or whatever want to come over and partake, they're more than welcome to. But we're going to crown the next world championship or champion on September 23rd. And
this is big.
It's going to be big. We're doing squirrel cleaning competition. We're doing...
Hey, can in the squirrel... I've been meaning to ask you this. Can you bring your own implements for skinning?
Yeah, you can. What was the crazy thing that you did?
Snippers.
Oh, yeah. Snippers are good. Snippers are good. Now, but the problem is, Clay, is these squirrels have been in the freezer for a month and a half. You don't think that matters?
Not in the least bit. Well, I will... I don't want to make any big claims, but I can skin a squirrel fast.
I know you can. I know you can.
But and the reason I know that it doesn't matter if they're frozen is a lot of times in the winter.
Come in late.
And that squirrel's been, you know, it's probably 40 degrees outside. So it's not, you're not worried about the squirrel. And he's been in your pouch since 9 o'clock that morning. And you skin him at 6 o'clock in the evening and he's hard as a rock.
You're not playing that game on a fox squirrel.
Oh, you could do it just the same. I'm not saying it's easier with a warm one. Yeah. No doubt. No, a warm one, I mean, you can clean them quick.
Clifton Jackson, who works for Arkansas Game and Fish, he has the Jackson Squirrel Rifle, is named after him. He's the reigning champion.
How fast does he do it?
Fast.
Okay.
Well, the reason why we don't have a stopwatch, it's you against somebody else.
Oh, really?
You lose, you're gone.
Hey, man, you ought to start doing the stopwatch. So you actually awesome. Have a
Do you think Guinness would put us inside of a book?
Yeah, they got a record for everything under the sun. Why not?
And you'll have your own book.
You could actually crown a world champion, like a world record squirrel
skin. Give
a
goal for somebody.
Yeah. I mean, they would need to be squirrels of similar size and temperature.
I'm thinking you could absolutely get Guinness out there.
Now, here's what's going to happen, though, and I'll go ahead and cut the mule off at the gate, is that when I bring my clippers up there and beat everybody, they're going to be like, oh, he was using clippers. You got to say.
It's fully legal right now on the Bear Grease podcast. Okay. You know, one of the most successful podcasts you can listen to. So, I mean, if I was going to get it out, here's the joint to do it. You can use your clippers if you want to use your clippers.
Okay.
That being said, this ain't no walk in the park, Clay Newcomb. This is a bona fide. I mean, have you ever been to a drag race? It's the same thing with a squirrel.
Okay.
Not only do we have that, we have it's always been the world's hottest wing-eating competition, squirrel wing-eating competition.
Mm.
We're going to up that this year. And we're going whole squirrel.
What do you mean? You got to eat the whole squirrel?
We're going to do a single whole fried squirrel with lava poured all over the top of it.
I love it.
And whoever can eat it, and I don't need anybody choking or doing anything stupid like that, but we're going to take away points if you let a little bit of protein on the bone, you know? So we're going to have that event. We also were debuting a whitetail movie at the Game and Fish.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That a bunch of people have spoken in.
Yeah.
We're having a youth BB gun competition in the morning where they'll be shooting at squirrel targets. There's all kinds of stuff to do. The only thing I'll say is our parking is really lacking. So you may have to find a place and skip down the road a little bit. But
it's kind of out there. It's kind of in an unusual spot.
It's in an unusual spot.
It's not hard to get to. I mean, it's like
off the interstate on right. 40th. But it's a...
The goal behind it this year is to really promote that facility and show people, because it's an upland facility. They're trying to put habitat in.
It's really cool.
Build back the prairie, get the quail population going. And you know, that's how nature is if you try to rebuild that upland bird, everything else is going to be more successful along the way. Game and Fish has been spectacular.
Brent Reeves is going to be a judge.
I hope he's been training.
Brent trains year round.
Do you think he'll pull out that case pocket knife and try to saw some stuff?
Yeah, yeah. So Brent's going to be there, and I'm going to be there. I'm not doing anything.
Yeah,
but I'm planning to be there, Joe.
Okay. Well, we expect you to be there.
Yes, I want to be there.
I want you to be there too.
Yeah.
I mean, your little documentary you made, was it $1,000 squirrel or $100 squirrel?
$100 squirrel.
Y'all seen it?
I have not.
He pulled a documentary when they were out on them mules riding around. And what was the premise of that deal?
Well, we killed two squirrels in the morning of hunting, and my buddy said, "That's a $100 squirrel. It cost us $200 to drive out here and shot two boxes of shells and killed two squirrels."
And that's kind of the moral of the whole squirrel cook-off, is you're taking these squirrels that are the smallest of game, and you're turning them into a premium meal. And so if you can do it with squirrel, you can dang sure do it with a bear. There ain't no doubt you can do it with an elk. And just enjoy the gifts that we have. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing everybody.
I love it.
There'll be some fathers out there too.
I'm going to be there. That's in my neighborhood too. I'll be there.
That's a lot of fun.
That facility hosts so much like educational stuff to the public. My wife is going there tomorrow. They're hosting a charcuterie board building class. My wife's going to learn how to do carpentry stuff. Huh. Like it's amazing. You could find fishing stuff. The Arkansas Game and Fish has done a really great job.
I think most game and fish organizations are suffering on trying to get people back in to hunting and fishing. And so they got to depend on photography, and they've got to depend on the culinary side. Cause if you can get someone through their stomach, you can dang sure that's a pretty quick trip right to their brain. Right. And teach them the value of what.
If we're talking about game and fish, Austin Booth, the new director of the Game and Fish, he's been there for about 2 years now. I mean, I didn't know the guy before he became the director. After he became a director is when I met him. It's not like we're longtime friends. But he's a heck of a guy. He's a heck of a leader.
It takes youth, right?
His leadership skills with the department, I mean, he's grabbed that thing by the horns, the Arkansas Game and Fish, and is doing some incredible stuff.
They've got a big piece of property they got to worry about, which is the whole state. Mm-hmm. And in that, there's a whole bunch of smiles that can be developed in this state if people just go out and take some of this free entertainment. And it's available in every state. I mean, you're going up to Alaska here before too long. If you were ever bored in Alaska, there ain't no hope for you.
Yeah. Something's wrong with you.
There just ain't no hope for you, man.
Except the wintertime when it doesn't get daylight. That's the only time.
Even you get the northern lights. Yeah. You get all sorts of stuff, man.
There's things to do.
So, the Bear Grease Render. On the Bear Grease Render.
That was the introduction to the render?
Yeah. Welcome to the Bear Grease Render. Now we're going to talk about last week's episode, the Mississippi. This is the fourth episode in the Mississippi series. Mm-hmm. I had some people that were like, Man, I wish you'd do four more.
I want to hear about the coastal erosion and the nitrogen bloom. You said you skipped right over it. Just said I'm not going to do it. But I was hoping
there's so much. And then I was talking to my dad, Gary Believer Newcomb, my biggest fan, and he's like, Clay, I'm tired of the Mississippi River stuff, man.
No, it's been really good.
He was like, he said it's interesting, but you know.
I like that about Bear Grylls. I mean, like, I'm probably like a part of the atypical crowd for Bear Grylls, but I found this series fascinating.
Really?
Absolutely. And I think you really brought like to the forefront of my understanding why the Mississippi River is important, how it impacts like the country as a whole. Like, I have enjoyed every episode.
What would you have known about the river before this?
I knew it was, it's funny, I was about to say, I knew it was the longest river in America, but actually that's the Missouri River.
So right, yeah.
I didn't know much, I guess. I mean, I know I drove over it and it doesn't look very pretty, but that was one of the things that I really loved about the series, and specifically this episode, was talking about the health of the river. Because you do have this impression when you drive over it, like the areas I drive over would be near Memphis, right? Everywhere around it, it just kind of looks muddy and the banks don't look that great. And it just you get a bad impression.
And see, that is, when you talk about natural systems and you talk about beauty, if an alien came from another planet and stepped in,
they always go to the desert.
Yeah. Good point, Joe. Yeah. Like, what would they perceive as beauty? Like, what would, you know, would they look at the Rocky Mountains and say, that's beautiful? Or would they look at this muddy, dark river system and say it was beautiful? To me, a natural system that is functioning like it was before humans got too involved is beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, like, when you cross over the Mississippi River on a bridge and look and see this big flat water that looks like it's still, but it's actually screaming down towards the Gulf of Mexico, that is equivalent in terms of natural systems that impact the landscape to an Appalachian mountain range, a Rocky Mountain range, the Ozarks, even on a smaller scale. I mean, and just to appreciate it is like, that is a dynamic, wild, ancient, hard to control, dominating piece of a geologic feature of the earth that is like, will be here longer than we will be here. When we are long gone, that river will be here.
I'm like you, man. When he talked about the health of the river, I think we get so shocked because when we open up our game and fish book and it talks about, well, you should probably only eat fish like twice a month or whatever, lead, mercury, all of this.
Right.
And we think about the runoff that's going inside of it. For him to state that the nitrogen and the things that were not bad for that part of the river. They were bad for the ocean, right? For the Gulf.
Yeah.
To hear the fishing stories, to understand that a flathead isn't as valuable.
That shocked me.
Yeah, that was cool.
A blue cat. I think a lot of our listeners who aren't from someplace that borders the river would find that eating buffalo, if they even know what a buffalo is, buffalo ribs are real good. And it's kind of just like a southern delicacy.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of like a drum, you know. A buffalo
it's a big scaly rough fish mean, you wouldn't think people would be eating,
but they're good. It was an excellent series. I learned a lot about the river, the 200 feet of topsoil.
Yeah, that was incredible.
Because how much topsoil do we have here? Inch.
In the Ozarks.
Yeah.
Pretty rough.
Yeah. You know, that's a good place to insert a addendum. When you talk about, I kind of gave some, if you actually listen to what exactly I said about topsoil, it would be a little bit contradictory, because people use topsoil in different ways. A soil scientist would not say that the topsoil layer of the alluvial floodplain of the Mississippi was 200 feet deep.
Because it's not on the top.
Well, no, because the topsoil technically would just be like the surface that was impacted by organic matter, and probably some of the deepest topsoils in the world are like 40 to 50 feet deep. But the alluvial deposit made by the river over the last gazillion years in places is 350 feet deep.
Whoa.
But it's not all topsoil. It actually would be like if you dug down 150 foot and brought that soil up to the surface, it would be of a different constituency than the soil right on the top. See.
What's our guy from Mississippi?
Hank Burdine. I let him say what he said because I knew what he was thinking. He said the average soil depth, topsoil depth of the Mississippi River, Louisville floodplain is like 180 feet deep.
If Hank doesn't get like a TV show to where he can have 30 minutes of conversation across the globe, we're missing out as a world.
Hank, I love Hank Burdine. He's everything that you feel like he is.
I watched him on a YouTube video singing a song about a hot tamale. Have you seen it?
No. Doesn't surprise me at all.
Oh, man. That was a variety show.
And I thought, you know, Hank needs a whole album.
Yeah.
You know who
we
else
gotta
was?
Share that.
You know who else was really, I mean, quite capturing was Mr. Bill. I mean,
yeah, Bill Lancaster.
Next time Meat Eater does another Campfire Stories, you guys need to include his story about getting tossed out of his boat. I mean, that was a great story.
Man, Bill Lancaster, this is behind the scenes Bear Grylls stuff. Let me back up. The hardest part of my job is getting the right people to talk to you. Some of the right people want to talk to you, like Joe Wilson and Hank Burdine. Like, they're ready to talk. Sometimes the right people don't want to talk to you. Bill was, he told me, like, he wasn't so sure that he should talk to me. Just because it's like, Bill is, he doesn't listen to podcasts.
He's been doing all right without you for 70 years.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know?
It's like, he's not doing this for show. He's not doing this to show off what he does. He literally fishes almost every day. He has for the last, since 1984, and fished before that a lot from 1969, but professionally for a living every week of the year since 1984.
Is he a one-man show in that boat?
He doesn't take anybody with him.
Yeah. You know, a lot of shrimp boat captains were like that. They were just one guy on a shrimp boat. And that's like the life of a boxer. You're the one who determines if you're winning or losing.
Yeah.
And that's what I got out of him. His work ethic's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, and then he had two stories about finding dead bodies in the river.
I didn't tell the second one.
I mean, it was just, you know.
You heard one, you heard them all.
How about the comparison to Tracy Lawrence?
Did you see the picture of him?
I may have. I don't know. Does he look like Tracy Lawrence?
That's what I immediately thought when I saw him.
Like, is this the thin, youthful Tracy Lawrence or the chubby,
a young, thin Tracy Lawrence with a mustache and the hair.
Paint me a Birmingham Tracy Lawrence or after.
Well, I don't know when he was in Birmingham.
Oh, his song, Paint Me a Birmingham.
I don't even remember that one.
Is this like Loretta
Lynn
all
young
over
Tracy
again?
Lawrence.
That's like his best song.
It's a compliment to Mr. Bill. Handsome fella. So, Mr. Bill, if you're listening,
you're a handsome man, Bill.
No, Bill, for real.
He made the right choice. He wasn't sure about this podcast.
No, Bill,
heck of a father.
Yeah. No, he was he was so fun to talk to, and you know, somebody that's dedicated that much of their life to anything is going to be good at it, you know.
You know, whenever I look at pictures of my kids from the past year or even just a few months ago, I'm so amazed at how fast they're growing up. And then it hits me hard. I'm getting older too. That's why planning for my family's financial security has become a top priority. Making sure we're prepared and having enough life insurance in case something unexpected happens and I'm out of the picture is crucial. And Fabric by Gerber Life makes it simple to get the protection that's right for your family. Fabric by Gerber Life was designed by parents and for parents to help you get a high quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. You could go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. There's no risk to apply. They have a 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can cancel at any time. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/bear. That's MEET fabric.com/bear. meetfabric.com/bear. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Assurance Company, not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. Whitetail Institute launched the food plot revolution in 1988 with a concentration on research and real-world testing of forage products specifically for whitetail deer. Whitetail Institute's research and development team of agronomy experts provide effective, personalized service. I've been using Imperial Whitetail Clover for a long time in a food plot back behind my house. In 2007, I killed the biggest buck of my life over an Imperial Whitetail Clover small quarter-acre food plot. Imperial Whitetail Clover is the only clover scientifically developed through years of selective breeding. Clover Extreme genetic stability provides extreme cold tolerance, disease, and drought tolerance. It really does. Clover is coated with Whitetail Institute's Rain Bond, a polymer coating added for enhanced seedling survivability. They have an exclusive offer for Bear Grease listeners, 15% off Imperial Clover when you use the code BEAR at WhitetailInstitute.com. That's WhitetailInstitute.com and use code BEAR for 15% off. The old timers say that the turkeys start gobbling when the leaves are as big as squirrels' ears and the red buds start popping. And we're about there. And we are there in the South. The Onyx Hunt app is one of my most valuable tools in the spring woods. With tools like coniferous versus deciduous tree distribution layer, you can save time by locating edges or transition areas of mixing habitats from home. Find an area like this with water in close proximity, and more than likely, there will be a gobbling turkey nearby. Knowing the exact boundaries of private ground ensures I stay on the right side of the fence, but can easily find public ground to go see if I can't strike a gobbler. If you do get one to sound off, using compass mode and waypoints will help you pinpoint his exact location, allowing you to move in and make the perfect setup to bring him right into your lap. Download the Onyx Hunt app today. You'll be glad you did. Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt this spring.
You ever fish the river, the Mississippi?
I never have.
We fished the Mississippi 3 or 4 times. And just like they were talking to
us. For what? Catfish?
Yeah, things with lips, you know? I can tell you one night we set up trot lines by a coal dock. Somewhere by Rosedale, Mississippi, or a grain dock, I guess, you know. And there was a light, and there was some grain floating on the water, and we could see things popping and above them. Ooh. And I thought, son, this is where we're going to do it. So we set out a 100-hook line. We went out, fished, come back, pulled this line. We maybe had three or four hooks without a fish on there. But every hook had a fish, and let me tell you what they were. They were about 16-inch gar.
No way.
Wow. Yeah, it was miserable because there was just a gar fish on every hook. But we've caught some big fish, man, 60, 70-pound blue cats out
there. That's amazing. Yeah. Man, my wife heard that, and she was like, we have to go. We need to find somebody to take us.
Your wife listens to Bear Grease with you?
She listened to it. She likes to fish. And she likes to fish.
We should have had her on the podcast.
So she, Colby, who was supposed to come today, he went noodling and got a flathead catfish. Mm-hmm. He gave us some of that. And my wife cooked it up and she was like, I just want access to this. I was like, we can go find some catfish.
I like it when a lady gets so dead set on meat that she's like ruthless.
That's my kind of woman.
She's turning well, into, she's going for it for catfish.
Sometimes I see that in people's eyes. I'm like, this woman would break the law for a catfish.
Austin, Rachel is not like that.
My wife had never known how to cook venison. And once she started figuring out her own shtick and what she wanted to do, she's like, get your butt in the woods. Yeah. Kill some deer. You know, it just totally changed the whole, you know, hey, can I go hunting this weekend? It's like, get in the woods.
Yeah, that's like, my excuse. What are you doing home?
That's my excuse to get to go to Alaska every year. My wife likes eating that halibut. Mm. And so I ain't going to Alaska for myself, boys. No.
Yeah, this is a servant leader right here.
This is me trying to beat this poor economy. You know,
there you go. Provide for your family. Being a great dad.
Yeah.
Gotta go.
Lesson number 3.
Clay, I have like a slightly anecdotal story about experience with the Mississippi. So I'm into bicycling, right? And I do bicycle touring. And so last year, I actually went on a bicycle tour from Kansas City to St. Louis. And half of that, when I met Boonville, was along the Missouri River.
Met Boonville?
Boonville, yeah.
Where?
Missouri.
Okay, Boonville, yeah. Missouri.
And you go from...
I bet every state...
has a Boonville.
east of the Mississippi and touches the Mississippi River has a Boonville. Yeah. We have a Boonville in Arkansas.
That sounds about right. This one has, I mean, it is where the trail that I was riding goes over the Missouri, and it is a huge bridge. I mean, it's, but I've run along.
Like a bicycle bridge?
It's
or a car
it's a,
bridge?
It's a traffic bridge.
Okay,
but it's
if
got
they
a bicycle
start building
lane.
Bicycle bridges, I'm moving.
No, here, yeah, okay, so that's
that was a dumb question.
No, no, no.
Good call, Joe.
Here is the kind of like roughly related part of my story, which is we did that. It was an amazing. And I have planned, this year I planned, I don't know when I'm going to do it, a biking trip from Northwest Arkansas down to Arkansas City, very near Greenville. And it goes along, Arkansas State is building the Delta Heritage Trail State Park, which is beautiful. And right along the Mississippi River goes from like West Helena, West Memphis, down to Arkansas City. So it's like 85 miles. And there's a section in the middle where the White River, the Arkansas River, all meet the Mississippi River. And there is not a bridge for 70 miles. And I was frustrated. I spent days on like GPS apps and maps just like, how in this modern day of 2023 can I not get across this body of water? And
You called me,
I called
you.
I called the state park and I said, hey, like, I know that the trail's not finished. You got an incomplete section. Like, how can I cross this body of water?
Is there a plan to build the bridge?
Yeah, so it's basically built along the levees, but also along some old railroad trestles. Yeah. There's a beautiful section that's down there near the Trust and Holder wetlands. And that's the section that's incomplete, and it's based around this trestle. And so one day I will ride it, but I just could not believe that in the year 2023, I called the state agency and said, how can I get across this like 4 mile
gap? You had
the
same problem that Hernando de Soto had.
Exactly. And she told me, she's like, you're going to have to go 70 miles around. That's the closest bridge. And I said, hey, do you think that I could like, I mean, I'm on the other side of the state. Do you know any, I see there's hunting clubs. Do you know anybody that I could like ferry me across?
This is a soft pitch to all the Bear Grylls guys. Is there anybody down there that would give him a ferry ride across this river on his bike?
I got told that was a lost cause because apparently the hunting clubs were not a fan of this burgeoning state park, which made the section of your podcast talking about the hunting clubs being this wildlife mecca really interesting because of the
cool story.
Kind of conflict of like, well, I want access to that
so
area
two,
as well.
So two points of conflict there. You're there. Well, I don't even want to get into this, but the conflict that you're stepping on that you wouldn't have even known is that, you know, public lands, there is conflict around kind of who controls those. And so it's such a big topic. It's hard to even want to talk about, but hunters are paying users of the land that we hunt because we buy licenses that go to do stuff for that land. A bicyclist doesn't do...
I mean, I'll pull out my game and fish card and...
Well, you're a hunter, though. You're a hunter.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a hunter.
You got this tie fishing pole on your back.
There it is.
Well, you're a hunter, but as a bicycler, like using public land, you don't have to buy a bicycle license. And so there's this conflict. Second conflict that we could get into, I had somebody reach out to me and say, Clay, thanks for highlighting in a positive way the land inside the Mississippi levees, because no doubt that is some of the highest priced land on planet Earth.
I had no idea.
Oh, those clubs along the river. Yeah. I mean, there's $100,000 memberships.
Yeah.
Oh, Joe, that's outdated.
Is $100,000?
Really?
Oh, there are clubs down there that... First of all, someone has to die, and they don't have to have an heir that would inherit the club membership. I personally know clubs that you couldn't buy into for $250,000.
No kidding.
I mean, like the Arkansas version of like Yankees, like
and
season
so
tickets.
That to a guy that just doesn't, in my opinion, and now I could pitch the other side of this and have a good argument against it, but I just don't see it that way. And I got no stake. I wish like crazy. I got no stake in the inside levees of the Mississippi River anywhere. Like, I'm not a member of a club, don't have any connection to them. But they would say that is a rich man's thing that is unattainable for the common man to hunt inside the levee.
So there was a guy that I was working with through the squirrel cook-off 10 years ago, and he reached out to me. He wanted to write a coffee table book based off of all the hunting clubs from about where the start of the levees are down to Baton Rouge. And because the history of those structures, you know, these are old plantations. There's presidents and governors and every banker, you know, has been inside these clubs. And we wanted to do a book, coffee table book, showing the history and their favorite meal at that club. Because a hunting club is a place to eat, socialize, and maybe shoot something, you know. And so the history behind those things is phenomenal. And it's hidden history.
I would not have known anything about it. I mean, I'm kind of the atypical listener, but it would have been completely invisible to me, except I was just trying to say, how do I get from point A to point B? There is not a single road.
Well, you're on a bicycle.
Bicycles don't do good in the swamp. Man. They sink.
You know, that rub between bicycles and all kinds of things is happening in our state. And there's actually an initiative in Benton County to where they're branding dirt roads as gravel roads cannot be paved. And it's
For bicyclers?
Yeah, and so it's a unique idea. The idea is in order to preserve the farmland and the wildlands in that area, if you don't pave that dirt road, therefore, there will not be a subdivision.
It stays kind of rural. It stays. Yeah.
And you could imagine who's behind this. Some big money.
Okay.
And so this is just in the last month. I actually cooked for that group. A buddy of mine, Wes Evans, is part of it. He's a big-time farmer in the county. And it's hard to change that paradigm that we're going to accept bicycles. And so this grassroots effort is there. And now
Now who wants it to stay rural? The farmers?
The bicyclers. Well, and the farmers. You know, most of the farmers could sell their property right now and never have to worry about it again with the price of real estate. They're holding on to the farm because that's their history and their heritage. And so in order to maintain that they can have their animals without some person in an 1,800 square foot house living next door to them complaining, they're getting with the bicycle groups.
Yeah, I see. So it's two kind of unlikely groups pairing up.
Yeah, gravel is like kind of the thing right now for bicycling because it's more of an adventure. You get out into more of the rural areas, and honestly, you don't have to worry as much about getting killed by a car.
Man,
I didn't mean to turn this into the
scare me all the time.
I didn't mean to turn this into the bicycling podcast, but that was my access point to appreciating the area around the Mississippi River. The rural areas, the levees, and all the stuff that I'm really excited about visiting the Delta Heritage Trail State Park once it is completed, which I believe is sometime in 2024. So
what about the Sultana Museum?
Yes.
I had never heard of that, but
that sounded awesome. Yeah. Sultana's still there?
Yeah, it's out in a private, it's on private land. You can't go see it. But the Sultana is in somebody's soybean field.
How about the tie-in with Holt Collier on one of my favorite episodes or series was Holt Collier.
Right.
And knowing that his killing of the bear and the deer fed the people that built that levee system.
Railroads and the levee system.
And then you got the 1927 flood, which I was aware of the flood because it even affected us in Northwest Arkansas when the White River backed up and flooded. But that flood being the worst flood killed more people than any flood that we've ever had. And most Americans don't know anything about 1927.
Right? I didn't. I mean, I had heard that there was a flood back in the day, and that's about as much as I knew.
Hey, let me do something here. I want to go back. I want to talk about the 2011 flood.
Yeah.
We're going to hold the flood stuff. I got to go back to my comments about the Mississippi River and I have to finish a thought. That's really important. I think it's important. It's the whole rich guy inside the levee thing. And yeah, the land inside the levees for hunting is not accessible to just average people. It's just not. And it's not that everybody that hunts there is rich. That's not it either. It's just...
They know people, a rich guy.
A lot of the guys that have memberships in those clubs aren't rich at all, necessarily. They've just had memberships in the clubs when they were not valuable. And that's the point. Hunting, recreational hunting, has made that land extremely valuable, more valuable than the timber. I wish I had made this point more clear. Y'all can tell me if it was clear. Timber companies owned all that land because it was not valuable for farming. It was not valuable for houses and living because it was inside the levees. It could flood. So timber companies owned all the land from Baton Rouge up to, you know, where the levees ended around St. Louis or from Memphis. Let's just say Memphis to Baton Rouge. Timber companies owned it. Timber companies are going to do whatever it takes to make money. They're going to cut timber heavily. There came a tipping point when the cultural value of recreational hunting became more valuable
than
the timber. And at that point, that's when all that land, and there's still some timber company land inside the levees, but not near as much as there was before like the 1980s.
These are all what? These islands are what, 25,000 square feet? I mean, they're huge.
Oh, there's hundreds of islands out there too that are literally islands of the river. But point being, the recreational hunting value of that land became more valued than the timber. It was bought by these private clubs. And in the 1980s, you could have got into an El Primo Mississippi River hunting club for probably pennies on the dollar of what it's worth now. So you didn't have to be a rich guy. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. So if my family had been down there within an hour of the river and we'd been like, heck, we'll just become a member of Diamond Point, and we'd have bought into that, today that membership might be worth hundreds of thousands
thwarted
of dollars.
By your own success.
Let me say this, though. But I say to somebody that would say that's bad, because there's this whole idea of that we're becoming more like Europe, where it's a pay-to-play game for hunting. I would say in this case, which with such a specific, unique, delicate riparian zone of one of the greatest rivers in the world, I don't care who's making it healthy.
As long as it's healthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's like, bro, I salute and love watching Will Primos hunt inside the levees of the Mississippi River and kill giant deer. I love hearing the stories, and at different times, I'm supposed to go hunt inside the levees, as a matter of fact, this year.
What kind of call will you be using?
I'll be using Clay Newcomb, Anchor, and Grunter.
There it is.
But don't you think that not only that particular area of hunting clubs, like, you know, guys used to be able to scrap together some money and go out and buy a piece of property and start a hunting club. I mean, that's so far out of reach for people these days, working men, you know, common working men, because there's men that work who work hard and make a lot of money. the common working
like
man.
These social media influencers.
I
like
mean,
men.
Say I had a deal that made dads better.
Yeah.
I was hanging out with a podcaster and stuff, and we decided that we were going to buy us a hunting club, and a hunting club's got to be 400 or 500 acres, or, you know, it probably ain't worth it. That's $1 million or better now in Arkansas.
Yeah.
You know, it's just out of reach unless you have so many members that at that point the population of hunters...
That the value would be less because of so many people.
I don't know what public access to hunting inside the levees is like, but that's one of the reasons that I like seeing things like the Delta Heritage Trail State Park, which obviously you can't hunt in the state park.
Do you work for them?
But
you said that like
really,
seven times.
The Arkansas Game and Fish in Springdale, too. We're going to hit all of it. No, I like seeing that. I don't know what public access is like, though.
There's along the Mississippi River, there is some public land that touches the river, but not a lot. I mean, it's the vast majority of anything from Memphis to Baton Rouge is going to be private land.
Have y'all ever just stood there and watched the barges going up the river? I mean, they're pushing 46 barges up a river with one engine, it's an amazing thing. And if you actually think about how many semi trucks that would have took, or rail cars, that river, I think 90% of all of our agriculture comes down that river.
Wow.
I mean, all of our grains, everything. And the unique thing is, like, was it early this year or last year when the river was going dry, right? It was making national news all the time.
Yeah, it was low.
And we would watch the news and think, boy, Memphis is getting hammered. That river is going to come up. That water comes from Ohio that fills up Memphis. It has nothing to do with how much rain is coming through Arkansas.
Right, right.
It's the Ohio Valley is where that water is troughed down. It comes down the river and feeds the Gulf, and it's our biggest highway.
Yeah.
I have a barge story that wasn't on the Mississippi, but I grew up in the Gulf Coast of Florida, and there was an intercoastal waterway built between the Choctahatchee Bay and a bay in Panama City. They would move cargo via barges, inland. And so they just dug it out in the middle of nowhere. And so they threw the sand out. You know, Florida's flat, but they threw the sand in these great heaps. So we would go, when I was 14, 15, 16, camp on the side of what felt like a mountain to a Floridian, right? It's probably a 30-foot drop down to this
and
water.
And it was 30 feet above sea level.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's the way to go
in Florida.
I have a distinct memory. I went out there with some high school friends, and we camped out overnight, and we cut down a tree, and we with hatchets, like, you know, just totally out of our depth. But we were having a great time. And we each had a log. We're carrying it along the bank at probably 2 in the morning, just having a great time. And a barge is coming. And, of course, that wake just is immense, even in this, especially in that small. And so we all started hoofing it, and there was a down tree, and we were trying to like hoist logs over this tree, and the barge is getting closer, and we're 16 and we're freaking out. And that barge points.
Are you in the water?
No, we're on the bank. There's
so you're close.
There's
so you're gonna get the
we're
wake
totally
is gonna hit you.
Yeah, and it's not gonna drag us out, but it's gonna get us wet, right?
You're 16, okay. Man.
Yeah, you know, having a great time. And that barge points that million lumen spotlight on us.
Oh,
and
really?
We are in the middle of nowhere, and I have this log on my shoulder, and I was kind of a bigger kid, and I'm struggling to get up, and this barge pilot gets on his loudspeaker and goes, "Go, go, go, you can do it, you can do it." I got to the top, and he went, "Yeah!" It was the best thing ever.
Awesome.
That's my barge story. I love it.
That is funny stuff.
It was an awesome series, Clay. It really was.
And good.
Four was probably the right number.
I'd love to.
Just with Gary, he's like, I'm getting a little tired of the river.
No, I like the diversity of topics too. Because coming from a former history teacher, I've always thought about the economics of waterways and that important role it played in our history. But I learned a lot thinking about the geography, and it never hit me just how pivotal.
There we go.
It is just having it in the middle.
Right. Yeah.
And America is so biodiverse and huge that we just don't think of that river substantially as, say, like Egypt. So in 2008, I went to Egypt and I boated on the Nile River.
Mm.
Egypt is the Nile River. Nile River is Egypt. Like, that is the country. I mean, it's a desert. There would be nothing without that river. I've been far south in Egypt where you can stand on one side of the desert, look over the river valley, and see the other desert. I mean, it's just 90% of the people live right there in the valley and into the delta. But in America, we take it for granted. And I think when I was listening to this, I was like, what would I take away from this if I lived in like this other distant part of the country? And I think I would become a lot more interested in the waterways around me. You know, if you lived in way in Southwest or wherever, it's like, our lives are defined by water, not just the economics that I've always thought about, but our biodiversity and survival. And then you think about the planet, like 80% of it's water in the oceans. I mean, water is everything. And so this series definitely caused me to think a lot bigger about that for sure.
Well, it was a gap in my understanding that I felt was a liability. For real, like 2 years ago, I was like, I just woke up one day and was like, I got to know more about the Mississippi River. It's like, I'm incomplete unless I know more about the river.
I found it odd that you weren't a Mark Twain guy.
Me too.
I really did.
The public schools where I came from never had us read them. I never read a single Mark Twain book.
I like Mark Twain so much. My son's name is Clem.
Uh-huh. Is that right?
Wow.
Based after Samuel Clemens. Because I thought that if I gave him a name such as Clem, he'd have a fighting chance of telling a story when he got a little old.
I bet he does.
So, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, the Mark Twain stories about the river, the country songs about the river.
I have a whole episode that I could do. I could do a fifth one. I'm not going to. About the blues.
Oh, yeah.
I felt like when I was scripting out this thing, I thought, I'm going to talk about the blues. And actually, I had a whole section where Hank Burdine talked to me about the blues that I didn't use.
You ought to put out a poll.
Well, listen, though. The first guy that I started looking for to tell me about the blues, I was driving down the road and I was looking for a podcast, and it was called the Chris Thomas King
Blues History. King?
No, I don't think so.
Convenient last name.
Chris Thomas King. You guys know the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah.
Okay, on that movie, there's a boy that plays Tommy Johnson.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, Tommy Johnson is the guy that is supposed to have sold his soul to the devil at the crossroads. And when the guys that are Oh Brother, Where Art Thou guys are driving down the road, they come to a crossroads, they pick up this African-American guy who gets in with a guitar, and it's Tommy Johnson. And that guy ends up playing a blues song by the fire on the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. That is Chris Thomas King.
Huh.
That's him.
He's got a podcast.
He has a podcast. I interviewed him.
Oh, wow.
Did a full interview with Chris Thomas King.
Huh.
Chris Thomas King came out with a book, and basically he says that the narrative that the blues started in Mississippi is not true.
What? Where?
Tell me it's not St. Louis.
No, it started in New Orleans, according to him.
That tracks.
And it's so, basically, I want it to be a whole Bear Grease, but.
Go 4-5. Go 4-5.
I would enjoy that a lot.
I can tell already after this render, you're going to go 5.
The differences between jazz and blues,
I don't have the bandwidth to like get more, but basically he says that if you ask anybody in the country where the blues started, they're going to say Clarksdale, Mississippi is what they say. And just like that's where it started. He says that Alan Lomax, this storyteller from the 1970s and 80s, nationally known, really, really renowned storyteller who told some major stories and made some major documentaries about the Appalachians. He gained national fame and basically went to Mississippi. And he says that Alan Lomax is the one who kind of was the guy that said, hey, the blues started
Are
here.
You doing this for safety reasons, not throwing this out, this fifth episode? Because
safety? Well, oh, afraid I mean, I'll get killed?
Well, I mean, you start saying that the blues ain't from the Delta?
Well, now it's from the Delta.
Well, that's the New
Chris
Orleans.
Chris Thomas King just says it. And he says that narrative doesn't add up. And he wrote a whole book about it and has a really strong thesis about how the word blues actually came from basically musicians in New Orleans making fun of blue laws, which blue laws would have been like religious laws, like you can't buy alcohol on a Sunday, or you can't, your juke joints can't be open on Sundays, stuff like that. There was a heavy influence in New Orleans, I believe, from the Catholics, and it was heavy blue laws, and then there arose this music scene that defied that, and it was about kind of rebellion against that. Then that's why the name, they called it the blues, because it was rebellion against blue laws. Well, and then the blues went up the Mississippi River, and his whole thing is, which tracks with the history of the settlement of the Delta, is that there weren't even African, there were not vast numbers of most of the Mississippi Yazoo Delta did not have slaves in it because it wasn't settled till after the Civil War.
If you,
you see
make,
what I'm saying, yeah, yeah. Like, you, like the place where they say the blues started before the Civil War, because they talk a lot about the blues being chain gangs of enslaved people singing, and there's
the Ganji dancers.
He says that that's, he doesn't buy it.
Huh.
If you did part five and you said the blues weren't from that region, and you said that the Delta Tamale is where all tamales come from.
Canceled.
You career would be over. Bicycle,
you'd have to go on that alternate career path that you were talking about.
All these people from Mississippi, I've gained their trust by doing all this Mississippi stuff. And then at this last
you
one, I mysteriously get drowned in the Mississippi River and Mr. Bill finds me.
Found the third one.
Whoa, what a movie. What a movie. Phenomenal. What do you got coming up on Bear Grease?
Lord of mercy. I don't know if I should tell. Should I tell the world what we're going to do?
Just a hint.
Well,
just us. Nobody.
No. Yeah, I'll just tell you guys, okay?
Okay.
Just don't tell anybody. Don't put it on social
that's
media.
Cool.
No,
cool.
It's actually going to it'll be good. I've had some people. That's a good question, Ben. I've had some people I've heard to our podcast referred to as regional, which I didn't necessarily like. And regional being the South. Like, I heard some people be
you're
like...
You're doing a show on the Baltimore Orioles.
Yeah, that's right. Bing, 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 bing.
Golly,
tune
I've
in
been
for Bear Grease. Baltimore Orioles. Well, I don't see Bear Grease as regional. I view Bear Grease as what I'm interested in. Happens to be a lot of what I'm interested in is in the South.
How convenient.
We're doing an Alaska Stories series.
Nice.
Where I have a very diverse, eclectic group of storytellers that are going to tell harrowing, near-death, wild experiences in Alaska.
Is this
I've got 9 stories right now.
This is like a Campfire Stories Part 3.
Yep.
Oh, yes.
Yep.
I'm excited
about
that.
So each episode is going to have multiple, like, full-length stories. Not interviewed. Like, I'm not even on the podcast other than just through... I'll say here's this guy and he's gonna tell a story. There's I don't even want to tell you what's on there.
Don't,
a lot of bear,
do it.
beard stuff. bear there's bear stuff, there's near drowning stuff. So
that's
cool,
awesome,
man.
I'm excited.
Yeah, it'll be good.
That.
It'll be good.
Yeah.
I like the story episodes.
Yeah.
Just with different people telling their stories, you know.
When I tell people about the Campfire Stories, the story I tell them about is the guide in Alaska who lost his boat across the bay and tried to go walk and find it. And then tried to do that terminal burrowing and had to tell himself, like, stop, you're digging
Isn't
your grave.
Weird.
So, I mean, more Alaska close calls and stories. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Alaska. The Hollywood of the hunting world.
Ooh. No kidding.
And you can make a movie anywhere, but the best movies seem to always be in Hollywood. It's like Alaska, man. Unending story plots there.
Yeah, it's a wild place.
Didn't you start this episode talking negatively about Alaska in the wintertime?
Well, not negatively. I just said sometimes the sun doesn't rise there and it's dark 24 hours a day.
Oh,
that's all.
Man. I'm getting
that's
conflicting
all.
Information here. Okay.
No,
all right.
I love Alaska. September 23rd, 2023, Springdale, Arkansas World Championship Squirrel Cookoff. It's big.
It's going to be big, man.
It's going to be big. Brent Reese is going to be there. I'll be there at some point. I'll just be there.
We'll tell Alaska stories when you get there.
Okay. I will have been to Alaska. So, Ben, Dad Class.
Dadclass.net.
Dadclass.net. Elon Musk owns dadclass.com. Don't go there.
Be
go
on
there.
The lookout for that special podcast on Cooking Up a Story.
Yeah,
I'll be there.
Joe's podcast, Cooking Up a Story.
We'll be there. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Dad Class. Check it out. Jonathan, you peddling anything?
Bicycle.
Nailed it.
Done. Podcast over.
I thought you planned that out. That's perfect.
That was so good. Oh, man.
No, we're done. That's it.
Mike's
out. Talk to you next week.
This show is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. Around New Year's, we get obsessed with how to change ourselves instead of just expanding on what we've already done right. Maybe you finally organized one part of your space and you want to tackle another. Or maybe you're taking your supplements every morning and now you actually want to eat breakfast. In the last year, I've been more diligent about going to the gym on a regimented schedule, and it's made a lot of difference in my life. Therapy helps you find your strengths so that you can ditch the extreme resolutions and make changes that really stick. Therapy is helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/Greece today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/Greece. Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.